Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is food columnist and author Meadow Lind. Meadow and I will be discussing about how you can discover your inner mystic chef and create dishes, even whole meals, to add an entirely transcendent and magical dimension to your holiday cooking. Her new book, titled The Mystique Cookbook, will help you nourish the body as well as the spirit and inspire love and romance from the kitchen. Good morning, Meadow. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on your show on this beautiful morning.
It is, and it's wonderful to have you on. I'm excited about your cookbook. Enjoyed reading it. It has some very interesting information on it, and it has a wonderful step-by-step information, and it's easy to follow. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment, and please don't spare anything.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. I was born. So I have been passionate about food and cooking and eating. I think they go hand in hand pretty much since the dawn of time, since the beginning of my life. One of my very earliest childhood memories is we had a very, very small house in Seattle. It actually used to be a houseboat. If you've seen Sleepless in Seattle, you're familiar with the houseboats. Ours was no longer on the water, but you can tell how small it was. And I remember being in the kitchen and grabbing a chair, and I wasn't even as tall as the chair, and dragging it across the kitchen so that I could climb up into the cabinets and pull down different ingredients. And at that time, my family ate very healthy. So for me, a treat was tahini, cocoa powder. I think I got some honey and maybe some desiccated coconut. And I mixed it all together and rolled it up into these little balls, which I called tahini balls. And I mean, I barely could talk. I barely could even walk. And I made these little balls and I put them on a pretty plate and I walked them around and I passed them out to my parents kind of cocktail style. And this was at very, very young age. And my mom tells me that I was barely 1 year old, and my parents, they're a little more earthy. They like to sit on the floor, sit by the fire, and have their dinner. And just at, like, I don't know, it's probably 15 months, I insisted that we sat at the table with all of the silverware laid out. So this passion and interest in eating well and living well and cooking has been with me since my very early childhood and all through high school. My nickname was, they're terrible nicknames to have, actually, as a teenager, was Mother Meadow or Martha, after Martha Stewart. They were not particularly the sexy names that you wanted to have in high school, but but they really spoke to my passions at the time. You know, when other kids would go out drinking and partying, my friends and I would get together and we would create dinner parties for each other, themed dinner parties. One time, at a friend's house, we created an entire Greek feast, and my friend and I dressed in Greek clothing, and we invited all of our friends over, and we were probably like 11th grade, and we invited all of our friends, and we welcomed them at the door with mariachis, or maracas, which I don't think are very Greek, but we figured it was festive, and we sat them down at this long dining table, and we served them course after course after course of Greek dishes.
Yeah.
And then when I graduated high school, my mom leads, and this is probably a longer response than you wanted, but you did ask for my entire life story. But when I graduated from high school, I started catering for retreats. My mom, for 40 years, has been teaching on a number of different subjects. And at that time, she was doing two-week-long intensive training retreats in something called Interior Alignment, which was a school that she had started based on feng shui and space clearing, which is a term that she coined about kind of clearing energy in a space and blending that with intuition. And she trained people in these two-week-long intensive retreats at our property in eastern Washington. And I did all of the cooking for 2 weeks for all of the guests at our home for that. And now they have a ranch here in California, and I continue to cook for these retreats. Now it's she's teaching something called soul coaching, also intensive retreat certification courses. So I'm not that great at math, but I think it's about 18 years that I have been cooking for the guests at our ranch. And so I have, you know, it started as a passion at a young child climbing up in the counters, but I've turned it into something that I have done professionally over many years. And the amazing thing is, while cooking for these retreats, when I first started, my mom would say, you know, make everything beautiful. And I was a teenager, and I didn't want to do what she said. You know, it just doesn't make sense. Like, why should I put the cereal in a bowl when it's already in a box? Like, you know, a bowl to serve it. But it's in a box. People can pick up the box and put it in their own bowls. And over time, I began to see that she was right. Don't let her hear me say those words, Mom. You were right. But that there is real power in not just the way food tastes, but in the way that it looks, and presentation is very important. So I began to see that when you take the jam and jelly out of the jar, the big old jar from Costco or wherever it's from, you know, and you put it in a beautiful crystal bowl, it actually begins to, it looks better, it tastes better, it seems better, you know, everything about it seems to sparkle more. And then also over the years, as I was cooking for these retreats, I started to see how the more joy and love that I put into the food, the more fun I had in the kitchen. I used to like taking wooden spoons and pretend they were microphones and dance around the kitchen while I was cooking, that the more people got enjoyment from the food, the better they said it tasted, even when it was really simple. They'd say, this is the best whatever I've had. And sometimes I'd be kind of shocked, like, really? You know, that's just a green salad, or that's just, you know, grilled cheese. But it's one, of course, using high-quality ingredients and knowing how to put them together well, but it was also that I so enjoyed what I was doing, and I put so much love into the food that it really made a difference. And then also when we eat, we make it into a celebration. My mom, I know it's crazy, she's got piles and piles of dishes, all different colors, all different styles, so that for every meal we set the table according to the theme of the meal, just like I did with my friends in high school. So if we're having a Mexican meal, we'll put out dishes that look Mexican or have the bright colors of Mexico and different placemats and different chargers, and then we'll set the table in a way that fit. You know, if we feel like we have a fiesta, maybe we'll pull out some piñatas and make every meal into a celebration. So often, so many of us, we eat in front of the refrigerator, in front of the TV. You know, as much, you know, I do it too. I get busy. I open the fridge. I'm like, I'm hungry. I grab something. I take a bite. You know, you don't even close the door of the refrigerator. But when I realized that when you make mealtime something special, a celebration, it really makes a difference in the way the food tastes, the way your body reacts to it, and overall your entire well-being. So it's been a long journey, but it has been a delicious journey from my beginnings with food to where I am now. So
fantastic. That's a wonderful story. Did you go to a formal cooking school, in a way, to learn all the different techniques?
You know, I didn't. I am self-taught, and at one point I did tell my parents that I wanted to go to culinary school, but at that time I had just finished a master's degree at Columbia University in French cultural studies. I actually did the master's degree program in Paris, and I wrote my thesis on the history and sociology of eating in France. And so after that I said, well, I want to go to Le Cordon Bleu. And my parents said, well, let's think about this for a little while longer. After having gone to private university and then private university for graduate school, let's take a pause before you go to trade school. You could have done that many years ago and saved us a lot of money.
There you go.
But in the end, I mean, that was their initial response. But
yeah.
But if I'd really wanted to do it, they would have, you know, helped me find a way to do
sure.
it. But I think there are lots of times when I wish I had gone to culinary school to know
mm-hmm.
those skills. But I also think, for me, having been self-taught has helped
yeah.
me keep this passion alive, too, because
right.
it's something I'm so passionate about. I spend my evenings reading books and
right.
searching the web and watching things on TV and learning by trial and error, and it has really kept that passion ignited within me.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I don't have some of the skills that a professionally trained chef would, but I sure have a lot of heart.
In all actuality, what really counts is the taste of the food. The skills may be for application in a commercial setting, but as far as I understand it, from what I've read in your book and just hearing you talk, you are a natural in the kitchen. So that's all the training you need.
Oh, thank you so much. And I have, I should add as a caveat, I have taken cooking lessons in different places. I've traveled the world and taken cooking lessons in Thailand and Mexico, and I worked with a famous chef in Australia. I helped, I was like 8 years old, and I helped this, her name's Babette Hayes. She's very well known in Australia and in England, but not here in the States. And I helped her at 8 years old prepare the feast for her daughter's wedding. And it was wonderful training, actually, because
mm-hmm.
I left that after stuffing 150 Cornish game hens. I left that thinking, yeah, I don't think cooking's for me. But those are famous last words, but I have continued on my path of cooking, but I didn't
yeah.
go the professional route, and perhaps that has to do with those 150 Cornish game hens.
There you go. Yeah. Well, at first it started out to be a fun thing, and then it became a chore, and then finally it becomes a nightmare. So when did you actually decide to use food and cooking as a career?
It's been, I think it's one of those things that kind of just has grown organically, that,
mm-hmm.
As I said, I started at 18 in the summers cooking for my mom's retreats, but then
yeah.
every year I was at school during the school year, and then, as I said, I went on to college and graduate school, and I've kept cooking in the summers, and then since all I'd ever known was school, I became a school teacher,
mm-hmm.
and I taught French for 8 years, so...
Mm-hmm.
During the school year, I taught, and in the summers, I cooked.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 years ago, I realized that it was now or never that I really wanted to follow my passion for cooking. So I quit teaching cold turkey, which was a big decision because I also really loved that.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to devote myself full-time to cooking and helping people find joy and passion in life through the way that they approach their meals. So I started
mm-hmm.
writing full-time and cooking and eating full-time at that time. But I think it's been a progression throughout my life that I've always been heading in this direction.
See, that's good because your cooking needs and desires derive from the passion of just wanting to cook for other people. Mine came from the desire to survive. So it's a little bit different.
It is different. And I do think the one in my family, and this is obviously different from just a survival mechanism, but in my family, if you did the cooking, you didn't have to do the dishes.
That's the same as mine.
Real quickly, I decided that I much preferred to be on the cooking side of things than
right.
the cleaning side.
right. So why did you and your mom decide to write the Mystic Cookbook?
It has been quite a journey. Now I'm using journey. Everything's been a journey. But
mm-hmm.
as I said, for 40-some years, my mom has been teaching spirituality and been in the mind-body-spirit field, and she
mm-hmm.
has taught many different workshops and helped many different people access their full potential through deep inner work. And we decided what a joy it would be to blend our two passions, her background in spirituality with my background in food and cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And share with the world this knowledge that we've gained throughout the years of these intense retreats, these seminars, where we were seeing the transformation that people were undergoing simply by how fun and joyous and delicious our meal times were. At first, we were a little nervous. I don't know, you know, what your relationship is with your mom, but we had a very good relationship. But working close together like that can be a bit different. So we dragged our feet for a little while because we knew we really wanted to do this, but we were like, oh no, what's going to happen? Are we going to fight? Are we going to disagree? And the even though our relationship was really good, and we'd worked together in other capacities, but it was with clearly defined roles. She was the teacher of the courses, and I was the cook, or, you know, I've helped out in her office off and on, but I was there as her assistant. And so we decided, well, we're going to leap in with 2 feet and see where it takes us. And it was so amazing. I think it was almost as though the alchemy that we were writing about influenced our lives. And while we were writing, we didn't disagree. I mean, obviously, you know, mothers and daughters have their things from time to time. But we actually got so much closer, and to the point where it's a little scary. We finish each other's sentences. My dad jokes that sometimes he can't tell us apart now. We were shopping the other day, and we went to a store that I had been to a few days before. My mom walks in. First thing, she grabs the sweater and tries it on and says, "What do you think?" Well, I started laughing. She thought I was laughing at her because it looked bad. But I was laughing because I'd been at that store 2 days before, and that was one of the only things that I had tried on, was that exact same sweater. And then she went to another aisle and said, "What do you think about this?" And it was these cupcake wrappers. And I said, "Those are great. I almost bought those." And then she picked up something, and every single thing that she picked out in the store was something that I had either purchased at the store 2 days before or had considered buying. And then we noticed that we were both wearing new pairs of jeans we'd bought recently. And we had bought the exact same jeans, same style, same color, same brand. I thought, oh my goodness. So not only did we not quibble over different ideas and different aspects of the book, but it seemed that it just, it really brought us together. And I think you can feel that in the book, that we're different. We approach the world differently. We have different views, but that we've really been able to blend that into the book and have this kind of mother-daughter alchemy, if you will, that blends our two backgrounds. And hopefully people can feel that, that it's not just a book about eating or a book about cooking, but it's also a book about families and about mothers and daughters.
Right. Well, the kitchen is the heart of every home, and obviously it's the hub to build relationships, loving relationships, that is. And so what your book did, it should be able to enhance that kind of relationship.
I love that. That was beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
I hope you write that down. That was so eloquently said.
How can the Mystic Cookbook help someone eat their way to an enlightened life, like you mentioned in your cookbook?
Well, that is a, that's a hefty question. And so my mom and I, as I've said, we approach things differently. We have very different, we've had very different upbringings, for one. And my mom struggled a lot through her life. She had a very difficult childhood. And, I mean, there was sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse. At 17, she was actually shot by a crazy guy out in the middle of the woods, or in the fields of Ohio. She was left for dead. So things were not easy for her on her path. She, after that, moved to Hawaii, and she lived in a Zen Buddhist monastery for 2.5 years, sitting seishen for up to 16 hours a day. The type of thing where if they think that you're thinking, they come and hit you with a stick so that you stop thinking because your mind needs to be blank. So she's had a lot of challenges, and then also a lot of time, like in the Zen monastery, looking for enlightenment. But it wasn't an easy route. Unfortunately, because of her challenges, I've had the good fortune of having a wonderful childhood, and things have been much easier because she made a huge effort for me to not go through what she has. And through that, we've learned that enlightenment doesn't have to come, or joy, or whatever it is you're seeking, doesn't have to come through struggle. It can. If you struggle and you overcome it, there can be great power in that, and you can, by turning trauma into triumph, there can be great power in that. And if you are undergoing challenges or tragedies, sometimes, you know, looking to think that at some point you'll look back and see how it put you on the path you are, or how it made you who you are today, and it made you more compassionate, can be a really helpful way to get through it and later turn it, that tragedy, into something that you can use for good.
Yeah.
But you don't have to. That, as we say, the top of the mountain of enlightenment does not have to be a struggle. For instance, my mom says when she was in the Zen Buddhist monastery, 2.5 years of sitting Seishen, she didn't get enlightened. You know, it hurt when they hit you with a stick. She learned how to pad her shoulders, you know, but she didn't get enlightened. But we've realized that by living joyfully, and one of the easiest ways to do that is through your meals. It's something that we all, everybody in the world eats. We have to.
Right.
But by approaching your meals in a joyful way, and in the book we talk about this in much more depth, and infusing your food with energy and spirit, and treating yourself as you would an honored guest. So often, so many of us will create these magnificent feasts for friends and family that we wouldn't ever dream of doing for ourselves.
Right.
But when you treat yourself as that honored guest, you show yourself that you are worthy of love and joy and being taken care of. And so by the way that you approach your meals, you can indeed grow by leaps and bounds and even go from what we call nourishment to nirvana. And once again, there's much more explanation in the book, and there's lots of activities and tips and techniques that show you how you can do this. But the main, I guess, takeaway is that you don't have to struggle to grow. You can do it amidst joy and celebration, and if you know, and when you do it with the way you eat, it tastes good too. You know?
Right,
so
right.
There's always joy in that.
Well, food is the sustenance of life. So when you look at it, whether from a spiritual standpoint of view or just nature in itself, it's a closed system. So we eat to feed ourselves, and it's a cycle. And so if we view it from that perspective, then we realize we tend to appreciate the things that we consume to nourish our body. Our body is our temple, so are we mindful of the things that we put in? The book talks about motherly love in India, where a motherly love is so profound in the sense of the food that she cooks for the family. And I thought that was very unique because it really emphasized the fact that personal vibration that you put into the food really affects the type of food and the flavor of the food and so forth. So tell us a little bit about that, because you talk a little bit about personal vibration affects the food we prepare. Do you actually walk through the process of the food coming from the ground when it was grown all the way to the dinner table?
And you're so eloquent in the way you say these things. I hope you're making notes of all these things. It makes such lovely sound bites. I just love the way you speak, Johnny. But you're right about that. That in India they say that a food cooked by a mother, or by extension a father, is filled with more love, or more, it's more nourishing for a child because of the love that that mother feels for her food.
Right.
And you may notice sometimes two people can make the exact same dish, same recipes, the same ingredients,
right,
and it doesn't taste the same. And there's no reason why it shouldn't taste the same, yet it doesn't, because of the energy that that person has put into the food. And either knowingly or unknowingly, you can consciously infuse different thoughts and emotions into food, or often just the way that you are or the thoughts that you're feeling at that time can infuse it. I don't know if you've ever gone into a restaurant and had a meal and felt ecstatically happy afterwards for no apparent reason, or come out feeling kind of angry. It might be just coincidence, or it could be that the chef was having a really good day or a really bad day. And I've had that experience where one time I went to this restaurant in Florence, and it was the most amazing meal I have ever had. It was a very simple pasta.
Mm-hmm.
It was linguine with some cherry tomatoes, fresh artichokes, and some shaved parmesan. That was it. But it really was as though there was magic fairy dust on that pasta. It was mm-hmm. so incredible. And it was, you know, maybe it was the fact I had to wait in line for hours to even get a table. The restaurant was so popular. Or the friends that I was with, or the surprise of finding this amazing restaurant. Or maybe the ingredients were extra fresh that day. But it may have also been, who knows, maybe the chef was in love. Because I went to that same restaurant a few days later and got the same pasta. And it was good, but there was nothing special. And
sure.
then a few years later, I went back to the restaurant again because I wanted to try again. Mm-hmm. And the third time, it wasn't even memorable.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, of course, there's so many different factors.
Right.
But it's not just the ingredients. Even though, the, you know, as I mentioned before, the higher quality ingredients makes a big difference. But also,
yeah.
as you said, the higher quality ingredients, often it's because they started out with a better, you know, childhood, if you will.
Right, right.
That's a good term. Yeah. In the book, as you said, we write about the whole process of food. From the moment it's planted in the ground and tended to and then harvested and taken to market, that like a snowball, if you've ever made a snowman, the snowball, you start out small and it rolls and rolls and rolls and gets bigger and bigger, especially if it's wet snow. And then you get a big, huge snowball that you can use to build a snowman. It's similar with energy. As anything, but food especially, as it's transported, mm-hmm. as it's grown, as it's harvested, it's picking up energy from all the people it comes in contact with, and also from the lands that it was grown in. The French talk about terroir, the specific region, the lands, the winds, the soil,
mm-hmm.
all of that goes into creating, in the French system, for, you know, say it's a Bordeaux wine, that terroir creates that Bordeaux wine, that a wine from Bordeaux is not like wine, even if it's still a Cabernet grape grown in Bordeaux, if it's grown in Chile, it's still the same grape, but it doesn't
mm-hmm.
have the same terroir. It's different. So
right.
it's the energy that it picks up along the way, it's the place where it's grown, it all goes into creating that eggplant or that tomato or whatever
right.
it is. And so we also talk in the book, we give different suggestions on infusing more vibration and energy into your food in ways that you
mm-hmm.
can do that. For instance, you know, throughout time, throughout history, throughout across the globe, different cultures say grace before a meal.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty ubiquitous because it works.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say grace, you can hold your hands over your meal or under it to infuse it with a little energy. My mom suggests, you know, if you're out in public, you can do it under the table. People don't have to know. You can
mm-hmm.
just say a simple thank you in your head. Because it actually works. And
mm-hmm.
by doing so, you can also change the
mm-hmm.
energy and vibration. It
mm-hmm.
you know, if you get a green tomato that's hard as a rock at a mini mart because that's all that you have available. Sure,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to taste as good as the bright red heirloom tomato growing in my garden.
Yeah.
But there are things that you can do by infusing that. I mean, it seems crazy, and maybe it is crazy, but by
mm-hmm.
infusing that tomato with love and joy, you actually can enhance its vibration, and it will taste better, and you
mm-hmm.
and you know, scientifically they probably can't prove that it would be more nutritious, but from a spiritual level, it has more in it, higher vibration,
right.
higher frequency. So there are things you can do no matter the providence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But also, as I said in the book, we give suggestions on when you're saying grace to remember the journey that the food has come from, to
mm-hmm.
the land
mm-hmm.
where it has come from, the region it's come from, the people who've all taken part in bringing it there. That often we, you know, we'll say grace
mm-hmm.
and we'll think of the person who's cooked it, but also
right.
there's all those other people that are responsible for its journey that
right.
make a big difference in creating
right.
that meal.
Right. In the book called The Secret Life of Plants, it does talk about the vibrations within the plants themselves. You got this happy plant versus a plant that's just struggling to survive and so forth. So it does relate to the concept of the origin of the various food that you're consuming. So it does make a lot of sense from that perspective. Coming to the colors of food, you have a very interesting section that talks about eating the right colors to transform your life. How can we do that, and what are some of the colors and the properties as it relates to transformation?
Wow, that is a big question, but a good one. And I love color. I'll start with that. I'm looking out the window now at my own garden, and it's heading out of, you know, it's winter time, but I'm still noticing all the colors there. I go out of my way to plant as many different varieties as possible. I have piles of seed catalogs. I love getting the most colorful heirloom vegetables and fruits available. For instance, I like to plant Chinese long beans, but I get a red variety, so they grow and they're red, these beautiful long beans, and then when I cook them, they turn purple, and then when I plant tomatoes, I have red ones and orange ones and yellow and purple, and even carrots, I have purple and yellow carrots in addition to orange, and beets, I'm looking out at the beets in my garden right now, and I have three different colors of beets, they're still growing. Three different colors of potatoes, even. I've got a purple-fleshed one, a yellow-fleshed, and pink ones that, you know, the pink ones have the pink skin on the outside, but they have pink on the inside, too. It's so cool. And I know this isn't exactly your question. I'm just giving you a little background on my passion for color. And then I have chickens, too, and right now they're running around my backyard nibbling on kale and rainbow chard. But they lay different colored eggs, too. They taste the same, but their shells are blue and green and peach, I think. But so color is very important, especially I'm very visual, as you said, you're visual, too. Mm-hmm. It makes a big difference on the way that we perceive a meal. If you think about watermelon, for instance, how would it taste if it were gray? It probably wouldn't taste the same. So one, the importance of color is we're very visual, and it really affects flavor and taste. They did a study where they gave different taste testers orange juice. And they gave them orange juice that tasted the same, two glasses of the same orange juice, but one was dyed a brighter color of orange. Pretty much unanimously, everybody said that the orange juice that was brighter in color tasted sweeter. And then they gave them different glasses of orange juice where one had sugar added, but they were the same color. And people could not perceive a difference in taste, even though one had sugar added. So the color makes a huge difference in our perception of taste.
Yeah.
So on a physical level, there are many different ways that color actually affects the way that we enjoy food and the way that we perceive it and even assimilate it. They did a study where they gave steak and French fries to some people, and everybody ate it and enjoyed it. And then they changed the lights. They'd had special lights on the steak. And when they changed the lights, it revealed that the steaks had actually been dyed blue. And blue is not a color that appears in nature very often. Most of us associate blue with putrefaction. Many of the people who'd eaten the steak, which was fine, it just happened to be dyed blue, instantly had physical reactions, and they felt ill because they had such a strong connection with blue equals not good that it physically affected them. So on a physical level, color affects us in many ways, but also on a much deeper inner level, color affects us, and you can use this in your cooking for spiritual growth. Colors are often associated with the different chakras, if you're familiar with the chakras from India, that they're different different energy centers throughout our body, and each one has a color associated with it. So you can use the color from a specific chakra to open that chakra further and to invite some of those qualities within your life, or if you want to unblock some issues, you might consider making a meal associated with one of those chakras, because color has frequency and vibration. They are different wavelengths, and we perceive it differently because of its wavelength.
Let me ask you this. The colors does relate to the different energy fields and, of course, the vibrancy of the colors enhance certain energies that you want to enhance. That brings me to the section in your book that talks about enchantments to spice your food. And one of the things that caught my eye was the, it's almost like love potion number 9, where you can actually cook, you know, there is an old saying I remember my mom used to tell me, you know, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach.
Yeah. a stomach unless I've learned, and this does not pertain to the book at all. This pertains to my history in dating. But it's the way to a man's heart through his stomach unless you've only been dating for a very short time. And then you cook for him too early, and he goes running. So you have to find that right timing to cook for the man before it's... Of course, I should add a caveat there. He goes running not because of the cooking, but because for some men it's too intense too early on a relationship to cook for him.
Very interesting.
But yes, with the enchantments, you're right. Because colors have different, and I'm going to take a step back, that colors affect us differently. For instance, fast food restaurants, you might notice, and chain stores, a lot of them use red because red is an appetite stimulant. Red is this color associated with your base chakra. It's vibrant. It's passionate. It's fiery. It's an intense color that you can then use that in your cooking if you want to create that passion, that vigor, that as you're trying love potion number 9. You can, you know. So if I've got a recipe, it's on one of our YouTube videos on our Mystic Cookbook YouTube channel, where for making it's called Mystic Elixir for Love. It's hot chocolate that you add some, it has chilies in it that you infuse with your intention for opening your heart further to love, and you sprinkle them into that cocoa. But also that red color that activates, if you do it with intention, which is very important, as we talk about in the book. You have to do these things with the intent that this will happen. These things aren't, you know, cayenne is, chilies are considered aphrodisiac, but it has to do often with the intent behind it. When you believe something, it comes to fruition in a different way. You know, if you just haphazardly throw it in, it's red, it's going to bring me love. You have to do it with that intention, and that intention of the capsaicin in the chili that is known for its aphrodisiacal, I'm not sure about that word, but qualities, but also that red color with the intent that the red is opening that base chakra, that the red is inviting that sexuality, that passion into your life. You can, and that those are the types of enchantments we talk about, not ones where you can actually compel somebody to do something against their will. It's a type that opens your heart further, that opens the doorway for more of whatever it is to come into your life. If it's love or joy or abundance.
Right. Well, I mean, everybody's taking good notes now, because the bottom line comes down to, if that dish does not kill him, you're in love.
Yeah. Well, you just put a little bit of cayenne in there.
How does feng shui work in the kitchen? You talk a lot about that in your book and setting the kitchen up in a nice manner. It does have to create energies, because I've been to some people's house where the kitchen seems to be kind of dark and gloomy, whereas I've been to other places to whereby they're very inviting.
And as you said in the beginning, the kitchen really is the heart of the home. Back in days of antiquity, it was the hearth in the center of the home where everybody gathered. It was that heart of the home. The fire in the middle was almost the heartbeat of the home. The family would gather there. It's where meals were made and stories were shared. And to this day, even though our homes are much bigger, many of us are disconnected from each other. We're constantly plugged into our technological devices. The kitchen is still that gathering point. It's where the children do their homework. It's where the mothers and fathers cook for their families. It's where the mail gets put when you walk in the door. It's the gathering point for everything. It's where families gather. And feng shui, as you know, it's an ancient Chinese art. It's also throughout different Asian cultures. There's different types of feng shui that persist to this day. And the reason, even though this ancient art started so long ago, the reason it's still around is it works. And feng shui is more my mom's area of expertise. However, over the years, I've learned a lot from her about it. Mm-hmm. And the way that you place objects in your kitchen and the energy that you create there makes a big difference in the way, not only the way that your food tastes and is prepared, but also because it's that heart, it's the heart of your home, the hearth is the heart of your home.
Mm-hmm.
It can radiate out into all aspects of your life. As you said, you go into some kitchens and it feels gloomy and dark and you don't feel very good. And then you go into others and it's bright and airy and light and it feels so uplifting. And sometimes it has to do with, you know, design, and somebody has a big fancy kitchen. But sometimes there's no perceptible way why one seems so much more uplifting than another. But it has to do with the energy that's created there. So there's a number of things you can do. One of the first things is you want to feel open and light and bright. So the first thing is clutter clear. Get rid of all of that junk you don't need. My mom always says, if you don't love it or use it, get rid of it. And I am the poster child for needing to clutter clear because I have the smallest kitchen in the world, which I do find somewhat inspiring for anybody who thinks they can't cook because their kitchen is too small. I have about 2 feet by 2 feet square of counter space in my kitchen, and I managed to write a cookbook. So if I can do it, anybody can do it. But clutter clearing, that's a big thing. Get rid of that junk. And as I said, I'm holding on to too much, but it's my passion, it's my love, it's what I do professionally. So I always say, oh, I got to save this, I got to save that. But really, if you don't love it or use it, get rid of it. It will open up the energy, and it opens up the space so you can find the things that you need on a practical level. The next thing is you want to have a sense of security when you're in your kitchen. So if the way it's designed, if your back is to the door when you're at the stove, you might unconsciously or subconsciously have a feeling of uneasiness, as though somebody could come up behind you and surprise you. So you want to, if possible, orient your stove so that you can see who's coming and going. If that's not possible, put a mirror behind the stove, and that way you have that feeling of expansiveness, and you also can mitigate that feeling of unease if somebody's coming behind you. The stove is also really important. Since, as you said, the kitchen is kind of that heart of the home, and the stove harkens back to the hearth of antiquity, that ancient fire, that the burners on your stove are associated with the abundance of the family, because it is really that heart of the home. So when you put that mirror up there, that big old mirror that shows you who's behind you, it actually can double the amount of burners. And the burners are, because of that fire energy, it can, and some of this is, seems superstitious, but you know, it doesn't matter. If it works, it works. So you know, even if it seems crazy, you can still do it. And if it makes a difference, keep it. If you, you know, if you don't like it, get rid of it. But but why not? You know, if you can if you can symbolically double the amount of burners and increase that feeling of wealth in your home, and not even feeling, it can actually physically bring more abundance into your home. Why not? You know? And then traditionally, feng shui follows along the elements, the fire, water, air, and what they have, wood too, is another one of the elements in China, but you don't want to have a cooling element next to the stove because you want that fire energy. You want it lit up. So, for instance, I have my refrigerator right next to my stove, and there is no other option because my kitchen, as I said, is so small. And that refrigerator, that cooling energy, can cool the fire of the stove. So what you want to do is put something there, a picture of trees, of wood, of nature, or I have a pitcher with wooden spoons. So symbolically, you're thinking that the wood could catch fire. It creates more fire. It, of course, won't. It's not going to catch your kitchen on fire. But you're, a lot of feng shui is, it doesn't matter if it's so. It matters what is perceived. So the perception is that that wood mitigates the cool energy of the stove, or of the refrigerator, to ignite more of that, the abundance on the
stove. Right, right.
So there's much more, and we go into much more depth into the book. I'm not going to keep talking your ear off,
yeah.
But the feng shui is important.
One of the things you talk about is also the cooking up the magic in the kitchen, and the emphasis is on the apron. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Oh, I love my aprons. For me, aprons are like my magic cape. I feel like Superman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Superman, he's Clark Kent. He's just kind of this mousy little guy. Oh, not little, but, you know, he's this mousy guy. And then he goes into that phone booth and he twirls around. He gets his tape and, not tape, his cape. And he suddenly becomes Superman. And that's kind of how I feel with my apron. Mm-hmm. I almost always cook with an apron. Even sometimes I laugh because often my aprons are a lot nicer than my clothes. And I'll be wearing, you know, junky clothes, even, you know, pajamas. And I go into the kitchen just to make myself a snack even. And I put on this apron, I tie those apron strings, and I think, wow, my apron's so much nicer than my clothes. This is, defeats the purpose of protecting my clothes from splattering food.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I realized that the apron is, it's almost like a sacred vestment. For me, it shows that, it demonstrates that change, that I am stepping into the kitchen. I'm transforming into someone different. Not someone different, but it's, for me, it's a hallowed moment. It shows that transformation of now I am going to be preparing food. And so in the book, we write about having a mystical apron, that you can create one for yourself. You can either purchase one from the store that has the different qualities you want. Maybe you want one that's, you know, rough and ready and shows I'm getting down to business. This is, you know, your barbecue apron. Or maybe you have a lacy one that shows a soft feminine side, or one that represents love or passion or whatever it is, whatever energy you want, you could buy one. Or you could get a plain one and decorate it. And we give suggestions in the book of the different ways that you can decorate it, the different things that you can use, and how you can infuse it with affirmations
mm-hmm.
and intention. And my mom and I taught a Mystic Chef weekend this summer, and we're still getting emails from people who are, and people created their own mystical aprons, who say that they're mm-hmm. cooking with their mystical apron, and that energy and love that they infused and those intentions they put into their mm-hmm. apron, they feel them going into the food as they're cooking. So it's we love our aprons, and it's so much fun to create a mystical apron. And as I said, it can show that transition from just everydayness to stepping into this hallowed world that is the kitchen.
Fantastic. Where can someone go to buy your book and get more information about you and keep up with your latest happenings?
The book is available anywhere books are sold. It is available from our publisher, hayhouse.com, also from Amazon and barnesandnoble.com, and from your local brick-and-mortar stores as well. And if you go to our website, we have a Mystic Cookbook website. It's mm-hmm. called themysticcookbook.com. There are some recipes there. There's links to buy the book and lots of other information as well. And it's been so much fun. People on Facebook have been sending us pictures of themselves or their pets with the Mystic Cookbook. So we're starting a new page on our website of readers with their books, readers
mm-hmm.
cooking different Mystic Cookbook meals and cooking in mystical fashion. And we're going to set up a readers page there so people can see photos of other readers. So we're very excited about
mm-hmm.
that as well. And once again, that's themysticcookbook.com.
Fantastic. One of the things that we are going into now is the holiday season. So obviously everybody is getting excited about cooking and dining together as a family and so forth. The things that you talk about in the book is creating positive energy in the dining room as well. How can one create that wonderful energy in the dining room to sort of embrace everyone in that mood of camaraderie and so forth?
Well, one of the things, as you were talking about with feng shui, you can do, mm-hmm. there are lots of different techniques you can do based on ancient feng shui in your dining room. And I know we're short on time now, so I won't go into all of the details on that, but that is in the book, in your dining room, how you can arrange the feng shui of your dining room to help with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can do something called space clearing. As I mentioned, that's a term mm-hmm. that my mom coined many years ago, and now it's
mm-hmm.
widely used by using sage or bells or incense or even clapping your hands, banging a drum, doing so with intention to clear out that energy, even getting out the vacuum and vacuuming, sure, it cleans your floors, but it also, it mixes up the energy. It clears out that stagnant energy. So those are some simple techniques you can do. There are more instructions about doing that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But additionally, the main thing that you can do is, especially around the holidays, we talk in the book about the sacred art of hospitality and invoking mm-hmm. that sacred, hallowed art. Back in ancient Grecian times, hospitality was the one thing that even a god could be punished for mm-hmm. if it wasn't offered with an open, generous heart. And it doesn't mean stuffing down all your emotions, because we know that the holidays can be stressful, especially, you know, you've got a niece who always comes over and puts her purse dog right on the dining table, or, you know, mm-hmm. an mm-hmm. uncle who helps himself to the fridge and eats the thing that you're planning to serve for dinner. You know, there's all these things that irritate us mm-hmm. and plug us in. But if you think of it as a hallowed act, this building of community, breaking bread with friends and family, it doesn't mean, as I said, stuffing it in. It's healthy to have boundaries. But also, if you spend time really focusing on each person and getting to know them and looking into their soul, I mean, that seems a little cheesy, but really focusing, it turns out most people care less about how clean and pristine your home is and care more about really feeling welcomed and accepted. So, you know, so often I've had a dinner party and I've spent hours cleaning and getting ready. And by the time people come there, you know, you're kind of tired. You're out of the mood. You put all your energy into cleaning and creating the meal, and they come and you're like, oh, no, I just want to go to bed. So sometimes it's better to put less effort into that preparation and more time and energy into each person and really spending time with them. I remember going to a wedding of a friend of mine, and it was her wedding, and I remember her coming up to me, and only was for a few seconds, but she gave me a hug and looked at me and said, I am so glad you're here. It is so nice to see you. And it probably only took a few seconds, but I felt so welcomed, mm-hmm. and I felt so much joy in this mm-hmm. connection to her, whereas often, you know, you go to a wedding and the bride is racing around,
and she's
practically, you know, my mom uses the word almost unconscious, because it's so much going on, and there's so much that she's not really present in the moment.
Right.
And as much as you can be present with people, and that's part of the sacred art of hospitality. And it could even be at the holiday time to honor an older relative, maybe collect their recipes and cook some of their recipes to show them, like, we honor you, we respect you. Or maybe you've had a relative who's recently passed on, and gather their favorite recipes from your family and bundle them up as a gift for everybody, as a memento, as a keepsake. There's lots of different things that you can do to ignite this sacred art of hospitality and bring people closer together. But also there's, anyway, I know we're running short on time. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, and also I think ultimately if one is mindful when one is eating, in the dining room or anywhere for that matter in the group setting, it really enhances the experience. So that is something very, very important that one has to understand as well. We're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Oh, I love that question. And from the beginning, we've said this, the book is called The Mystic Cookbook, but mm-hmm. we've also said it's more of a, it's a cookbook for life rather than a recipe book, if you will. It does have a number of, I think, delicious recipes. I created them, but it gives steps for living a delicious, joyous life. And I would say that the main thing I can say in the last few minutes here, without going on for mm-hmm. hours and hours, mm-hmm. as I am known to do, but is to love what you eat and eat what you love, and do so in a sense of gratitude and joy. So many of us get so caught up in eating a certain way, being a certain way. I don't eat this thing, or this is bad for me, or I can't mm-hmm. do that. And it limits you beyond what foods you eat. it limits you in all aspects of your life. Because food, as we said, is such an important part of our everyday lives, that when we make these choices about food, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't choose to eat organic or GMO-free or whatever is most aligned with your beliefs. We believe strongly that that's important, but it's also when you limit yourself, it can be limiting in all those other aspects of your life. I would say, you know, if you're going to eat a piece of chocolate cake, rather than beat yourself up about it, enjoy that cake. Take that bite. Enjoy every luscious taste and flavor and nuance and celebrate it. Because when you feel that guilt runs deep into your body. Studies have actually shown your body absorbs it differently and takes on more of the calories when you are stressed and guilty when eating it. So there is actually a physical reason to really enjoy it, but also on a spiritual level. Enjoy it. Stop beating yourself up. And that would be my recipe. Enjoy what you eat and eat with joy. And of course, eat healthy food, but find ways to nurture yourself and to find that the love and joy, and you'll find more love and joy in all aspects of your life when you eat that way.
That's a wonderful recipe for living. It's all based back into the kitchen and about food, the sustenance of life. That's wonderful. One of the things that your book talked about, and I'm just throwing this out there for those who love 50 Shades of Grey, you got to read this cookbook, because there's a section there about sensual meals. The first thing that draws me to that section is dining in the dark and eating by the moonlit night.
Now, I have not yet read 50 Shades of Grey. I've heard it's pretty racy. Now I'm wondering, oh, no.
I just had to throw that in there. I didn't read it either, but I'm just saying, like, the first thing that came to mind when I said, ooh, dining in the dark, that's pretty cool.
I have to say, our book is very G-rated. So
okay. I realized that. I was just teasing you on that. But I thought
no,
it was
I love
wonderful.
It. I love it.
I mean, it gives you a different dining experience, so that's wonderful. Well, Meadow, thank you for the great recipe for living that you've shared with us earlier. And thank you for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be the publisher and editor-in-chief for Chicken Soup for the Soul Books, Amy Newmark. Amy and I will be discussing about the latest Chicken Soup for the Soul book, which she co-authored with Jack Canfield and Mark Victor Hansen, titled The Gift of Christmas, a special collection of joyful holiday stories. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Meadow, thank you again and have a great day and happy holidays.
Thank you so much. It's been such a joy, Johnny, and happy holidays.
Thank you. Bye-bye.